Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Author to Author podcast. I am your host, Pamela R. Haynes, award-winning author of two books called Loving the Brothers and Loving the Sisters. I interview independently published and traditionally published authors from around the globe. The Author to Author podcast is available on 20 plus streaming platforms and 6 radio stations, namely East London Radio, Pantengo Radio, UK246.com, Chalk Hill Community Radio, LWR Talk Radio, and the Sounds of My Life radio station. The podcast is sponsored by Dalgetty Herbal Teas. Use the discount code A2AS6 for 10% off your next Dalgetty tea order. In this week's episode, I interviewed Dr. Linda Ince Greenaway, and we talked about her book, Hard Truth, Growing Out of Adversity. Let's jump into her interview now. See you on the other side. Hello there, and good afternoon to you. Thank you for joining me on the Author to Author podcast. How are you doing, Linda?
I'm well, thank you, Pamela.
Good, and thank you for agreeing to come on the podcast and for your book, which I've just received. So I'm looking forward to having a dip into it. And your book is called Hard Truth. So yes. I'm looking forward to getting into that with you. Okay. But tell us where you are in the world right now, and in terms of your heritage, what country are you representing?
Right. Well, where I am in the world right now is Stevenage, Hertfordshire. I live here. In terms of my heritage, I am a Barbadian. I was born and bred in Barbados, but I came to the UK when I was 14 years old. So well over 50 years.
Up until your 14th year, whereabouts in Barbados were you based?
In St. Michael, not far from Broad Street, Kensington New Land, if you know that area.
In town itself.
In town itself, not far from the Oval Cricket Ground, you know, so around there, that was my stomping ground, you know.
Coincidentally, I had a book launch at Legends, at Shuttle House Legends, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I could see the cricket ground from, it wasn't very from far there. From there.
Yes.
Right, yes, right. So yes. I can place it.
Do you know Brandon's Beach?
Yes, I do.
That's yep. right. That's where we would go early in the morning to bathe. Yeah, so it was right near there.
So tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Barbados at that time.
It was good. I mean, I had a really great childhood. My mum was a seamstress. My dad was a tailor. And I grew up in a Christian family. I was taught lots of Christian values, which I think stood me in good stead for later life. But I had, and I have, 7 sisters and 1 brother. My brother's now passed away. But we grew up as a warm, loving, connected family. And I have really pleasant memories of growing up in Barbados. You know, it was a good childhood, I would say.
Yes.
I was very fortunate.
So your formative years were spent in Barbados?
Yes, until I was almost 14.
Mm. And well, what local schools did you go to?
I went to Westbury, and then I went to St. Leonard's School. Because I didn't pass the 11 plus, so, you know, I went to St. Leonard's School. But, you know, it was a good school. I did well there, and I enjoyed my school days as well. You know, made friends, was popular. I was popular at school. Enjoyed going to school, enjoyed family life, community life, all of that. It was very good.
I take it you've had the opportunity to travel back to Barbados since you were 14. Describe for us what a perfect day in Barbados looks like.
A perfect day in Barbados looks like lots of sun, sea, people being friendly, just chatting to you. I see lots of changes when I go back there. So, you know, sometimes you have in your mind this picture of what it was like, but it's not like that anymore because it has changed. And it has changed with the times. but I still find it one of the most beautiful places to go to. I feel right at home when I'm there. I meet people. I have no family there at the moment, but it feels good because people are so friendly, so accommodating, and I enjoy, just the general feel and the atmosphere of Barbados, which is really good.
But it sounds like an idyllic childhood and an
Yes,
idyllic place to go back and visit
absolutely.
as well and totally unwind. So whilst things might be changing, I still enjoy the idea that, when you go out and about, people say good morning, good afternoon, how
Yes,
are you doing? In terms of
absolutely.
traveling up and down, I feel quite safe on the
Safe,
island. People
yes.
very friendly in terms of, I think we had to try and get to Bat's Point by using public transport. And people are like, well, no, you just relax. We're getting off the stop before and we'll put you off the
And
stop
we'll,
afterwards. I just found everybody really enabling and really helpful. So
yes.
fundamentally, I think Barbados hasn't changed,
It's
but
great,
it is moving forward
it is, it is.
as well.
Yes. And I'll tell
So
you a
you
really,
came.
really good experience. I was there in February this year, and we were traveling on those little buses. I don't know if you could, they call them the jitneys, And as we were getting off, we were rushing, my husband and I, and I left my purse on the seat, and it had in my cards, it had in my money. And one woman just stretched out of the bus and said, "Here you are, you've left your wallet." I just thought that that was so good. It was so
Yes, you
good.
don't get that happening very that
Very
somebody
often.
else would see that as an opportunity to
Yes.
permanently deny you of your items. So that's really good to know that that
Yes,
still
that's still
exists.
on, hang on. Yes.
So you came up here when you were 14. Obviously, you must have come with your family as well. Whereabouts in the United Kingdom were you based?
Initially, we lived in London, and then we came up to Stevenage about 6 months after I came here. And so Stevenage was a new town at the time. Well, it's still, I suppose one could still say that it's a new town, in terms of timing and 8 years and so on. But it was a new town, it was underdeveloped. My sister and I were the first two black girls to go to the school that we went to. So, and I'll have to tell you about that because it was really, really, it was awful, in those days. But yes, so we came to Stevenage in 1965, 66, no, 66, 1966, we came here.
So tell us then, what was it like being one minute in a very warm, friendly community and then going to a new place like Stevenage at the time? What was that like for you and your sisters?
Yeah, it was a change of major proportions, I would say, because it was like coming out of the heat and coming to the cold. And especially as I came in December, it was very cold. And not only was the place cold, but the people were cold. And so I experienced during those early years of my education, I experienced a lot of racism, and discrimination, not just in school, but on the streets, on the buses. It was just dreadful. It was awful. And I hadn't experienced that in Barbados, because there might have been differences in class, I think. But as a child, I didn't notice it. But when I came here, there was a stark difference in the way you were treated by teachers, by your peers. It was very, very different. And also, apart from that, then there was the acclimatizing. In terms of the temperature, and how different it was very, very different, a very different lifestyle. And you had to very, very quickly learn how to change, learn how to adapt to that. So I was fortunate that I had a really compassionate mother, a mother who cared and who encouraged us to have a positive identity. Of ourselves and not to forget where we had come from, and so that was it was a hard time. I would say it was probably one of the hardest times in my life, making that transition. It was a difficult transition, I would say.
I mean, it's hard enough being a young girl. It's hard enough going through adolescence and puberty. But then
Yes.
to also have those additional layers on top, it's good to hear that your mother was supported. But, mums couldn't be everywhere. They couldn't be in the school with you. They couldn't
Absolutely,
be always on the
absolutely.
road with you. So, how
Yes.
did you build resilience? in those
Well, I
circumstances?
looked at what my mother had done. My mother had lost her husband. That was the reason why we came to England. She had lost her husband, and she was only in her 40s, late 40s. And she lost my dad, and she decided she was going to come here to make a new life for us. And she was a really resilient person because she knew how to fight. She knew how to stand up for herself. And I looked at her and I emulated a lot of her characteristics, you know, the kind of person she was. As a Christian, she was a strong Christian woman. And so she believed in God, and she believed that, you know, even though it was a hard move away from Barbados, it was the best move. It was the best thing she could do because she was standing at the crossroads, you know. So standing at that crossroads was a critical place to be. And the decision she made showed her not just her intentions, but it showed her resilience. And I learned as a result that, you know, life does not come easy. And if you want anything, you have to fight for it. So I gained that fighting spirit from my mum. She was a very, very strong person. So for me, resilience really means stepping over every single hurdle that approaches you. And there were many, many hurdles to overcome in those early years.
Thank you for that. Linda, when you completed your education, what milestone did you achieve next?
Once a well, again, I wasn't that successful when I left school, to be honest, because of all of those issues that I was facing and the low expectations at school. I wanted to become a nurse, but I decided not to. But there was something that actually interrupted that, my career, the path on which I wanted to go, and it changed my life. It changed my life forever. What happened to me, and I'm sure that you will come to it at some point, we will come to it, but it was the thing in my life that made me write this book and talk about it and share my experiences with others. So that milestone, my education was not really completed until my early, you know, sort of late adulthood, you know, when I started to see the importance of studying and addressing some of the issues that had held me back, you know, some of the mindsets that others had placed on me. And I th then began to think, but you know what? I can do a lot better than this. So I started to study. And at the part of that study, I went back and did a course initially in typing, thinking that that was what I was going to do. But God led me in another path, and that was down the road of social work because I then wanted to help people out of my own experiences. So I went into social work, and that was when my career really kicked off and when I began to do really, really well, really well.
Fantastic. What university or college did you go to study social work?
I went to Stevenage College, and then I did my MPhil, and I did that at Brunel University. And then I did my PhD at Birmingham University.
Oh,
So,
wow. Well, I
yes.
mean, obviously, I note straight away that you're, Dr. Linda Ince Greenaway.
Yes.
But what did you do your PhD in?
I did my PhD social policy because I wanted to make a difference in terms of policy formation in a particular area called kinship care. And this was how Black families look after each other. And so I did a qualitative study which looked at, you know, why grandparents have to look after their children, their grandchildren, and what happens to their children when the family, the construction of the family breaks down, and how grandparents stepped in. And it was something I remembered from my own childhood, how important grandparents were. So I studied that, and it was a unique study because no one had done it before. And so it was a really, really good area to in which to complete my PhD.
Well, we've heard of people who, it's taken them 7 to 10 years to complete their PhD. So congratulations
Thank
to
you so
you.
much.
But tell me, what were the challenges, at studying at that level?
The challenges, once again, was barriers that people put in your way, try to put you off and make you think that you are not capable and that you can't do it. There's a lot of discouragement, and unless you are prepared to go that second mile to fight for yourself, to fight for what you believe in, you won't do it. And so I had to persevere. I had to work hard, you know, and I think that working hard, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is what actually does it, because you come to believe in yourself and to believe in your own capabilities, and you don't allow other people to determine where you're going to go and what you're going to do. And I think that that was what actually did it for me. Self-belief all the way, all the way, all the way. You know, I just believed in myself, and you know, I kept visualizing what it would feel like to wear that cap and that gown. You know, I just kept on believing that. So, and I did it. It was like I when I walked away, when I handed that PhD in at the university. You will know that Birmingham is one of the old universities. It's a major institution of education. So, you know, to go in there and to talk about something called the Afrocentric perspective paradigm was quite new to them. This is back in 19, oh, it was late 1990s. Yeah. And so to do that was quite an achievement.
Oh, absolutely. And I hear you when you talk about gatekeepers along the way who can be your fellow professionals who do not see the value in the work that you're doing, and you have to persuade boards and other academics that this is an area worthy of being studied. So
Yes.
thank you for your perseverance in that
Yes.
area.
Yes,
And then
indeed.
on top of that, you then wrote a book. And so tell us about your book without giving away the whole thing. Is it fiction, non-fiction? I haven't really had a chance to look into it yet. But
It's
yes, tell us about
non-fiction.
your book.
Yes, it's a memoir. So non-fiction. So it's the story of my life. And we've already talked about how I grew up in Barbados, you know, and coming here, immigration, what that means, major transition in my life. It talks about losing my father, death. So a lot of it is about how I coped in those early years with separation and loss, and how those values I spoke to you about were very important. I think the major chapter in the book and at the heart of the book is the hard truth. And the hard truth really is about how I got married at 20 and my husband died months after he was in the police force. First, second black police officer in the Metropolitan Police lost his life, and my fight. So that was where my fight began, fighting for compensation, having I had my son days after my husband was born. So the trauma of that, I talk about the trauma of that, and I talk about how I raised him as a single parent and how that today he is a very successful doctor. You know, so it was success, success all the way. So people can read about the success, how I did the success, how I overcame the barriers, the trials, the triumphs in the book, the trauma. And I show them where the trauma is and how what you have to do to become resilient in that sense. We were just talking about resilience and how important that is. And so I show people how I personally did it and how I overcame a lot of the things that had troubled me, not just as an adult, but then as a child in some instances, the loss of my mum when she came here. You know, losing my mum shortly after, a year after my dad had died. You know, that was a major loss as well. So a lot of it is about loss. And because I wrote the book when COVID, during the COVID period, it speaks to people who are going through loss, people who have lost their way, people who are single parents, children who are wanting to succeed, students who are wanting to succeed. This is how you do it. This is how you overcome. And you have to be committed in order to do these things. You don't become successful overnight. And that is what I show in the book. Also, in the book, there's a lot about my employment. I talk about my experiences as a manager, managing two social work teams. And then I talk about setting up my consultancy and also my coaching business and how I became a life coach and how important that is in terms of helping. I am essentially a helper and I do service. I do service and I find service very rewarding. So that's what I talk about in the book.
Oh wow, well, what a fantastic read. And I have to confess that you have supporters out there, and one of our episodes was by a woman called Oria Rees, who I
Yes,
know that you met, and
I've
she
met her.
couldn't push this book enough. She took it on holiday with her recently and contacted me immediately to say, Pam, you must interview this woman. She has a story to tell. So I thank Aurea for that and for connecting us. But it seems as though you managed to pack a lot of issues into that book. You must have seen me do a deep sigh when you mentioned being a manager and managing social work teams. I can certainly relate to that. What were some of the challenges, without talking out everything in the book, but what were the challenges at that time of being a social work manager in the field?
Well, Pam, I was qualified in 1985. So this is going back some time. And at that time, there were very few Black people in social work. So I was one of the first. I did a lot of first things. And I was one of the first Black managers in the, one of the London boroughs. And that was tough. So people have to read about it to hear what I went through, and not just managing a team, but managing an all-white team. And males as well. So the tide was against me, but I think that I had developed enough self-confidence by that time, to hold on and to know what I wanted. And that really helped me then to fight the battles that I had to contend with in the team, and not to allow it to put me off or to sidetrack me off of the course that I was going on, because I kind of knew where I wanted to go to, but there were these hurdles in the way, and I had to find a way to jump over them, and I think at that point I talk a lot about support, because support, and especially a broad base of support coming from your family, from friends, from people that you talk to, from your colleagues, where they would be supportive. I think reaching out for that support was really important to me.
Yes, I've always told, trainee probation officers, that's the kind of teams that I manage, that you have to have your core friends around you,
You
people who
do.
are in a similar profession and
Yes.
understand what it's like to walk
Yes.
in black skin and be a black woman,
Woman, yes.
who is a manager or a senior leader.
Yes. Yes.
Otherwise, you cannot do this that kind of job, which is
Yeah.
stressful on its own, but you
It
cannot do a good job without
is.
having support of family,
Absolutely.
friends, and peer
Yes.
colleagues who you trust their opinion. When you run things by them, and people try to gaslight you, you
Yes.
gaslight your reality
How do you
of
imagine?
what's happened. It's really good to be able to pick up the phone and say, X, Y,
Yes.
and Z happened today.
Yes.
Am I reading too much into those kind of behaviors? Is it
Yes.
real? And it's good to have people
And it's
to
good to have that
support you.
feedback to keep your balance. But I think too that it wasn't just bullying, but it was psychological bullying, which was another level. I think that was another level of bullying, because psychological bullying just phases you out and you can't stop. I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop thinking about what, and I doubted myself. Often I doubted myself and started to think, well, maybe they've got a point. Maybe I'm not meant for this job. I think too, Pam, that if I wasn't a Christian, I probably would have given up, but I kept praying about it, and I had a very strong faith. And I believe that if God had put me in that position and he had opened that door, then no one could close that door. And I didn't allow them to close that door. So, that inner belief was very important to me, and I think it was what sustained me through those very difficult years.
Yes, and I also think that having balance outside of work, having other activities that you're doing outside of work, can really help as well. I mean, people are now calling it work-life balance, but I
Yes.
definitely felt the need to make sure that I was still doing the things that I wanted to do outside of the job. Otherwise, the job would just become consuming,
Yes.
never taking any time off. 11 o'clock at night, you're still talking
You're
about
still
your bad
working,
day
you're
at
still
work. These
working.
are all signs, and they can lead to breakdown, in
Yes,
the workplace.
indeed,
We could
indeed.
definitely relate
And
to
because
that.
you want to prove yourself, you want to prove that you are what, against those odds. You want to say, I can do it. So you push yourself 110%. You get to the office early, you leave late, you take work home, and all the time you do not realize the level of stress that you're taking on and how it's impacting on your body. So there's a lot to think about in that chapter in the book.
Absolutely. And this whole thing, which I'm going to ask you about, really, this whole myth about having to work twice as hard to get half as much leads to nervous breakdowns, leads to a burnout because it's not sustainable.
No, you
And
can't.
I think this leads nicely to asking you, why did you set up your life coach business?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Pam. But I think that by the time I had got to that, I was thinking now, because I'm a person that likes preparation, I like to prepare for what is to come. So I started to think of retirement and I thought, well, what can I do? Because I don't want to be in an office all my life, and I thought life coaching. I had a chat with my niece and she'd had a little bit of experience of someone life coaching her. And she said, Auntie Linda, I think you would be brilliant at it. And I thought, do you really think so? She said, yes, I do. So of course, like me, I did my research on it. I looked it up and I just did the course. And yes, and I decided that that was the path I would take. Then that would lead me into retirement. It would be something I could do, not only because I had the skills, but I am a very interpersonal person, if you like. So from the time I walked into that, I just knew it fit like a hand in glove, just like when I went into lecturing. I took to that like a fish takes the water, because that's the kind of personality I have. So it was really great to do that. And the feedback I got from the lectures and from the students was absolutely brilliant.
If we go back a bit, can you tell our listeners what is a life coach? A lot of people banter it about, they have it as their title of one of the things they do, but I'm not really certain that people know what a life coach is.
So life coaching is a therapeutic intervention. People from all walks of life come to life coaches because they've got a problem and they want that problem solved. And it takes someone who can kind of not tell them what to do, but ask them the right questions. And when you ask the right questions, it leads them to begin to expand their minds and to think of, again, the barriers, and to think about the blocks, and to think about the overwhelm, and to think about how they can get around it. And that's what I do. You can do that for anybody who wants to find their way in life. So you can do it for parents, you can do it for leaders, which is what I do. You can do it for young people. You can do it for virtually anyone who wants to create a new vision of what their life could be like and to move from where they are to get to where they want to be, So that is what the life coach does. And a really good life coach is good at digging, if you like, beneath the surface and getting at the things that the client may not necessarily see. So what do you think about this? And what would you do about this? What's your best answer for this? So all the time, a coach is encouraging a client to kind of find answers to their problem without you telling them what the answer is. I think that's what a good life coach does.
And can you tell us then what's the difference between a life coach and a mentor? I do believe that we should all have people to mentor us around different aspects of our lives.
So a mentor is a person, I've done a lot of mentoring of students. So this a person who wants also to reach a goal, but it's a different kind of goal. And they need somebody with the experience that they're looking to get to mentor them in how to be, for example, a good social worker or a good teacher or a good medic or whatever it may be. But that person has the experience, the exact experience that they want and that they want to gain from the mentor. And so that's how the mentor helps them to become that person, to become a professional. Whereas a life coach is enabling, has a more enabling kind of approach to the work they do in terms of how they encourage people to find the answers for themselves.
Right, very, very clear. So thank you for those definitions. And in your business, then, how does that work? Do people sign up for 10 sessions, 20 sessions? How does the program work?
Yes, initially I encourage people to come and have a free half an hour session with me. And if they agree and if we come to, sort of agreement that they want to work with me, because I never force anyone. And if they want to work with me, given what we have discussed, then we will have, yes, a package. I will set out a package, and this is what the package would look like over the next 10 set. There'll be 10 sessions in this package, and you will pay, for the session. I set my price, and then they agree, we have an agreement, and we work with that agreement. And my expectation will be that they'll turn up for the session and that they will engage. I will give them activities to go away and to do, and I'll expect them to come back and to feedback about where they're moving to, how they're progressing. So yes, it's a package that I offer.
That's fantastic. So thank you for explaining what that's about, because I do strongly believe in that people need life coaches, they need mentors, they need supporters, at different aspects of their lives, to help them to continue to move forward. So when you're not writing your book, when you're not lecturing, when you're not doing your life coaching, tell us, how do you spend your downtime?
My downtime is mostly with church activities. I'm a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, so I play a role there teaching. I use my skills, so I teach the class. And we go out a lot, my husband and I. We go for dinners, we go to theatre. My son and I, we've always had this thing about classical music. So we go to the proms, we go to other concerts, plays. I'm constantly in the West End. And I travel quite a lot. So I love traveling. I've always traveled, and I do that quite a lot. I enjoy that aspect of my life. The other thing I do quite a lot in my downtime is word searches, puzzles, Scrabble. Love Scrabble. Would play till the cows come home. Those are the things I do. I also go swimming, and I like walking, so I do that just to keep fit. And a balanced diet. I believe in a balanced diet and a balanced lifestyle. And I think that is what keeps me looking the
Absolutely, absolutely. Looking very young
way
and
I am.
rejuvenated. And I just love to hear about the other activities that you're doing as well, outside of the other professional bits and pieces that you're doing as well. Back to the book. How long did it take to write? Who designed this beautiful cover for you? And tell us a bit about your future projects that you have coming up.
Right. So first was who, how long did I take to write the book? I think in total it probably was a couple of years. I wrote it over. I took the time during COVID to write. I had it in my head for a long time, but during COVID, when there was nothing to do, I started to write the book. It was first published in the States. And I then discovered that it wasn't selling here because people found it. So I republished it here by some publishers called Acquire Press. The cover was my idea, and I asked them whether they would kind of create this rose, create something that was like coming out of distress and so on. And the rose represents that, and the broken glasses, because my life was broken. So that was how that came about, on this cover. I'm just about to change the cover again. but this is the one that's on Amazon at the moment.
Why the change of cover?
Well, once I changed the publishers, I felt it was a good time to change the cover. As I say, I wanted to represent something. I wanted some, although my photograph was on the first book, but I wanted something that would represent me coming out of adversity. And that seemed to do it, So that was why I changed the cover. But nothing in the book changed, just the cover.
Yeah, and I mean it's quite a common thing to do, isn't it, as well?
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
I follow an author called Terry McMillan, an American woman, and whenever she republishes her book in other countries, she changes the cover.
The cover,
So you
yeah.
can, it's quite common to see the same title, the same content,
Yes.
but with a brand new cover on it as well.
Yes, yes.
So yes, that's quite a common thing to do. You're giving me some food for thought.
Oh, good.
I'll see. But I was asking you about future project. What happens next? Now you've written the book, now you're
Yes.
promoting your book, and when you are a self-published author, you find that you're doing a lot of the marketing and the PR stuff
Yeah.
yourself. But
Yes.
what have you got coming up over the next 6 months?
Well, I'm working on, publicizing the book, maybe looking at maybe doing a TED talk, a TEDx talk. I want to do that. I also want thinking of I've started writing my next book. I'm kind of putting, fingers to keyboard and thrashing out some ideas at the moment. And I think my next book's going to be just, it's going to be almost like a sequel to this book. So it will kind of carry on and talk about this next stage that I was talking about moving into retirement and what that means, for me. Yeah, so that's what
Oh,
I'm working on at the moment.
well, that's fabulous because the story isn't done, is it? You
No,
know,
it's not.
you wrote it at a particular time, but time is moving on. You're doing other activities, you're growing and learning in other areas. You have your business now and how that's going. So the story is still continuing, isn't
It's
it?
a
So there could
continuing story.
be a book two or a book three out there
I hope
as well
so.
to reflect, yeah, all the things that all the activities that you have done. So that's absolutely wonderful. Would you say that you've caught the bug now in terms of
Yes.
writing books?
Yes, I think I have. I've been writing for, I don't know if you know this magazine called Brains Magazine, and they contacted me and said, would you be an executive contributor? So I write to them, and that is published on all the platforms, the various platforms. And people can just go there and read what I'm writing. So at some point, some of those might actually turn into a book. You never know, because they're different to all around leadership and how leaders should behave and how they should treat staff and so on. So something might come out there, I don't know, but I'm writing them and I'm glad to see that they've been accepted and been published. It's good.
Oh, that's wonderful. I did a talk recently giving writing tips for aspiring authors. And the
Yes.
one thing that I was saying that there's different kinds of writing. You don't have to commit to doing a book. You
Yes.
can, be a
Yes.
contributor
Yes.
towards a magazine.
Yes.
So it's good to know to hear that you're doing that because it's a different type of writing, isn't it?
It is. It is a
I
different type.
found that sometimes you can be very constrained in the word count, for
Yes.
example. I
Yes.
wrote an article for the Voice newspaper last year, and they're quite
Okay.
clear. They only want 800 words.
Oh, yeah,
So to try and
that
get 2,000 words down to 800 can
is.
be an art form within itself. So would
Yes.
you suggest that that's a good way for people to start off writing, perhaps writing for a
Yes.
magazine or
Oh,
a newsletter?
absolutely. Yes, a newsletter, a magazine. A lot of reporters, started that way, didn't they? Writing off for a rag, university. If you're in a university, you could write for them, and just increase it over time. But it's a good way to start, because a lot of people are afraid of sitting down and writing a book. So if you don't want to do that, I think this is a good way to start, just writing for a magazine or a newspaper or something that will get you started on your way.
Yes, because it's all about feedback, isn't it, as well?
Is it?
You will get feedback from an editor, you'll get
Yes.
feedback from another columnist around your book and around your writing. You know, even writing a letter, you know, when they have a page in newspapers where you're encouraged to write to the editor with
The
your
editor, yes.
views is a good way
Yes.
to start writing as
Yes.
well.
I'll tell
How
you
has
another thing that
your
I could actually do. And I mean, over the years, I've kept journals. I like gratitude journals. And I have written in journals for years and years and years. And every time I pick up a journal, I see the thread of things, that I was sort of was important to me at the time. I can see now that I can pick up those journals and I could start writing just using those journals. So that is another avenue that I have, if it's something I want to do. Depends on
Oh,
how much
wow.
I want to share.
Yes, of course. But writing in itself can be therapeutic
Yes.
and cathartic, and it can
Yes.
also be a way of forming a good habit of writing
Yes.
every day just by keeping a journal. I
Yes.
think people like Oprah Winfrey have talked about, journaling from
Yes.
childhood, and
Charlotte, yes.
she possesses several volumes of her journals. Not none of them have been published, and that's not the point. The point for her is to get how she's feeling out and
Out.
onto the paper.
Paper.
If people wanted to reach out to you, Linda, how would they do that?
They could do that by emailing me. I'm Linda with a Y, lifecoaching@gmail.com. Or they could go to my website, and that's www.connectedlifecoaching.co.uk.
Can you say that again, please?
www.connectedlifecoaching.co.uk. But I have another website that will be coming up shortly for just the book. So that this is where I'm going to be doing all of my work with the book. So, but I can let you know when that's there. But it's not there yet. It's to come.
Okay, no problem with that at all. And if people wanted to buy the book, how do they do that? Where can they find it?
On Amazon, I think Amazon's the best place, but there are other places. I think when you go on Amazon, it will show you. I think it may be in Waterstones, so they could try there. And if they wanted to get directly in contact with me to get the book, I do have copies, so they could do that. If they go on Amazon, please, please, please give me a review when you've read the book.
Yeah, I mean that's crucial, isn't it?
It is.
Because the more reviews that you have, the more visible the book becomes.
Yes.
When people are browsing or they put in particular keywords, your
It's...
book is likely to come up. And
Yes.
we want to increase book sales. Are you on social media?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm on what
Right.
what am I on? LinkedIn. I'm there on LinkedIn, and I am on Facebook.
Right, and under your name as Linda Ince
Linda.
Greenaway. Right.
Yes.
Okay. So people can get in contact with you that way as well, especially if they wanted to
Absolutely.
organize a personal copy of the book.
Yes. Or
Yeah,
if
that would be
someone is
absolutely
listening
amazing.
in who would like me to come and speak at an event, I'm also open to that as well.
And that's how Aurea found you, didn't she? You were
Yes.
both at the
Yes.
same event.
Yes.
Was it a couple, was it last year or the year
Yes,
before
I
that?
think it was the year before that that I met her. And so we were at the same event with our books there, and we were at the same table, and that was how I met her. Lovely lady.
Yeah, but she speaks highly of you also. So it has been an absolute pleasure just capturing a snippet. I know that we could talk for probably another hour, but
Yes.
just to capture a snippet of you and your life in your memoir, Our Truth, Growing Out of Adversity. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Pam.
It's competition time now. I hope you were listening very carefully. In which parish in Barbados did Linda spend her formative years? Contact me on Instagram at lovingtheauthor with the correct answer by this Friday for your chance to win a copy of her book. Good luck, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.